From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. We're all worried about the economy, and the nation's $350 billion deficit is just making matters worse. On today's Fresh Air, economist Robert Heilbrunner reinterprets the deficit and tells us it's no excuse for letting the country crumble. Also today, a talk with Alex Chilton. As the lead singer with the Box Tops, he topped the charts with the hits The Letter and Cry Like a Baby, but it's his more obscure records with his band Big Star that made him an important influence on other musicians, and those records are being reissued. TV critic David Bianculli enters the world of infomercials, and Maureen Corrigan reviews the novel Strong Motion about a man-made earthquake that hits the city of Boston. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The U.S. airlift known as Operation Provide Hope began delivering food and medical supplies today to the republics of the former Soviet Union. The $78 million airlift will consist of about 64 cargo flights over the next 2 weeks. The flights will deliver tons of supplies, much of them left over from the Persian Gulf War. Russian troops and American Salvation Army workers will guard the food against black market thievery and deliver it to soup kitchens, hospitals, and orphanages. An American aid official, Tom Brennan, stressed that the flights were basically a symbolic gesture and that the total need in the region is far greater. Algeria's main religious party, the Islamic Salvation Front, has called on its supporters to defy the state of emergency imposed by the authorities yesterday. In a separate development, the government says Islamic extremists have killed 8 police officers. From Tunis, Jackie Rowland reports.
The Islamic Salvation Front said the authorities would not succeed in dissolving the party. It reassured its supporters that Algeria would one day become an Islamic state. After a comparatively calm day, the authorities have now released details of 2 attacks which they say took place last night. In Algiers, 8 police officers are reported to have been killed by a gang of Islamic extremists. In a separate incident to the east of the capital, 2 more officers are reported to have been stabbed to death, again by Islamic extremists. There was also a new outbreak of violence in a small town to the east of Algiers. Security forces clashed with fundamentalist demonstrators, leaving at least 2 people dead. These latest incidents bring to more than 50 the number of deaths since Friday. For National Public Radio, this is Jackie Rowland in Tunis.
The State Department denied today that there was any information to support new charges by some Haitian refugees that they were threatened and jailed when they were returned home. The statements were being used as evidence before the Supreme Court, where human rights groups are challenging the Bush administration's plan to send back thousands of Haitian refugees. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
Human rights advocates accused the Bush administration of ignoring new claims that Haitian refugees faced political repression when they were forced to return to Haiti. The statements were made to the United Nations by 42 Haitian boat people who fled in November after the military overthrow of Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. They were forced by U.S. authorities to return to Haiti, but fled a second time. The Haitians, who have since been granted entry into the U.S. to pursue political asylum, said they were threatened, jailed, and beaten by Haiti's military regime after they returned. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher said today that U.S. diplomats in Haiti have checked out 4 statements made by the refugees, but found no evidence that any refugees face political persecution. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 20 points to close at 3,245. This is NPR News. United Airlines said today that it's cutting back its orders for new airplanes in a move to reduce its capital spending by $6.7 billion over the next 3 years. The cuts will include more than 100 Boeing 737 and 757 airliners. Boeing officials had no immediate comment, but Boeing's stock was off by almost $1.38 a share after the announcement. United is Boeing's biggest customer in the United States. The Dow Corning Corporation today released hundreds of pages of internal documents that have been at the heart of the recent controversy over silicone gel breast implants. The documents seem to show that Dow Corning officials failed to adequately study the safety of their implants in spite of repeated warnings from company staff. NPR's Michael Scholar reports.
Dow Corning was under pressure to release the papers. First from the Food and Drug Administration, which itself released the documents today, but also from mounting bad publicity. Over the last few weeks, many of the documents had been leaked to the press, and Dow Corning's reputation was taking a beating. Internal memos and corporate minutes show the company's own staff had raised questions from the 1970s onward about the lack of safety studies on silicone gel implants. There was evidence that silicone could leak from the implants, but little research to see how that might affect health. Dow Corning officials maintained today that the documents tell only part of the story, and they provided written comments claiming potential health risks were adequately studied. Their claim will be scrutinized next week when an FDA advisory committee meets to discuss the company documents. This is Michael Scholer in Washington.
Author and historian Alex Haley died today of cardiac arrest at a hospital in Seattle. He was 70. Haley co-wrote the autobiography of Malcolm X and wrote Roots, an account of his family's history from West Africa through slavery in the United States. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We can all remember presidential elections in which the candidates tried not to talk about the economy because the subject was considered too complex and too dull. But this time around, the economy is the number one issue because so many voters are worried about jobs, health insurance, and just making ends meet. Economist Robert Heilbronner is enthusiastic about the public interest in the subject, even if he's less than enthusiastic about the state of the economy. Heilbronner is a professor of economics at the New School for Social Research in New York and the author of several books which have been used as college texts. His latest books are The Debt and the Deficit and a new edition of his 1974 work, An Inquiry into the Human Prospect. He's, of course, following the candidates' economic proposals. He says although the Democrats are trying to be bold, there's something that's holding all of them back.
They all want to sort of overcome Bush's timidity, and they all want to do something more socially imaginative. They want to do something to directly recognize unemployment as a problem and launch anti-unemployment problems, measures, and so forth. But I think that all of them, even the Democrats, are terribly constrained by a fear, and the fear is something called the deficit. They're all afraid that to do something on a large scale, something more than just lowering interest rates or forgiving people taxes for something for a while, will require the government to borrow money and go out and build major projects. And they're right. I mean, that is, I think, the only way to turn the country around. But when you borrow money, you run up the deficit. And as soon as you say the words deficit, people blanch, faint, I mean, have apoplectic fits. And so you can't do that. So even the Democrats are terribly constrained by this hobgoblin called the deficit.
Now, let's look at the deficit. You said that the deficit is used as an excuse for not investing in lots of important things. Yeah. What do you think the deficit is holding us back from investments?
Let me rephrase. No,
this.
let me start one step back. May I?
Yeah.
What we have to do, and we haven't done, is build up a strong public sector. I mean the roads and the bridges and the harbors and the air transportation and the air radio, what do you call it, guidance system, and the things that government does to provide what I often speak of as the embankment on which the private railroad runs. That embankment has been perilously ignored. In Japan, in France, in Germany, in Austria, and all the countries of Europe, during the years of boom, they built the public embankment. As you know, when you go to France and ride on those fantastic trains, or Japan and other fantastic trains, or Germany and the wonderful road system, or the general level of public support you find everywhere in Europe, you do not find in this country, where you have but to open your eyes in downtown New York or try to get across the Queensboro Bridge or ride the damn train to Washington. And you know that we live in a country which may be very rich, but which is starved in its public facilities.
Now, why is that? Does that have anything to do with the Reagan-Bush philosophy of not having government spend a lot of money and, you know, withdrawing government from a lot of places it had been before?
Yes, I think, look, I think there are three explanations. The deepest explanation is, I think, some funny American antipathy towards government. In Europe and Japan, people look to government investment with a great deal of pride. Paris, the most beautiful city, all Frenchmen say. I mean, all Germans exult in the wonderful road system and so forth. Americans, for whatever reason, regard the government not as the not as a source of pride. I don't mean what government does. I mean what government builds. Not as a source of pride, but with a shrug of the shoulders or with a general feeling that the less of it that there is, the better. Whatever the government does, the private system could do better. So underneath, there's some deep suspicion about government. On top of that, there is indeed the Reagan-Bush philosophy, which is whatever thing you can eliminate from government, you should, because the economy will run better. So they eliminate it like mad. We spend about one quarter as much as a percentage of GNP on this public capital, this infrastructure, as we did in the 1950s. There never was such a period of running down of public infrastructure as the last roughly 15 years. And that's where the crux lies. And the question is, what to do about it? And because it is public capital, it's not something you can ask General Electric to do. I mean, you don't make money building bridges, and there's no possible way of building a bridge and putting a toll on it big enough to make money. You're not going to build a high-speed train unless you put in a whole new railroad embankment, and not to speak of financing the research and development. It's going to be a public project, though later on it may be put into private hands for running.
Okay, so this takes money. If it's a public project,
yep.
It takes a lot of public money. We don't have it now. I mean, we do have this huge deficit, and we're paying enormous interest on it. So where do you propose getting the money from?
Well, there isn't any place to get it from, really, except borrowing. And the thing that the public has to understand is that there are two kinds of borrowing. Very bad borrowing, which everybody would like to minimize, and good borrowing, which people should applaud. And the way to make people understand those heretical statements is to point to their own lives. You meet a man in a cocktail party, and after a while you say to him, he tells you about his finances. He says to you, well, last year, you know, I went $50,000 in debt. $50,000 in debt, you say? What'd you do that for? He says, well, I had these losses at the track. You mop your forehead and tell the guy he's headed for real trouble. He answers the same question, $50,000, about, oh, yes, I took a mortgage out on the house. You say, that's very different. That's good. Good for you and where to live and so forth. You meet another guy who's a businessman. He tells you that last year he borrowed $100,000 for his business. You look at him saying to yourself, what did he borrow it for? He tells you later on, well, he can't meet the payroll. You know that man's going to go bankrupt. You get the same man, or a man looks just like him, and he tells you he borrowed $100,000, and what for? Well, he's putting on this new wing on his shop, or he's buying these new machines for his factory. And you say, you know, this is a guy who may be riding the path for growth and profits.
Aren't we in the position, though, of the guy who says he's borrowing $100,000 for his business to meet payroll, and he's borrowing also another $100,000 to build a new wing?
Now you're talking very good sense, and I think that is in fact what we're doing. We're borrowing partly for capital and partly for payroll, and we ought to be borrowing only for capital, except because it's a government. Sometimes in bad times you borrow just to give the economy a shot in the arm. But essentially what you say is right, and there's one big problem that makes this so difficult for ordinary people to understand. It is that we don't run a budget, I mean really a set of figures, which would enable people to see what we're borrowing for. In the government, you put all the expenditures together, whether they're for capital goods or for interest or whatever, and you tuck it up, you compare it with taxes, and the difference is called the deficit. The borrowing is the deficit, and there's literally no way, unless you're an expert and take the detailed figures of the OMB, Office of Management and Budget, there's no way for an ordinary person to say, aha, last year we borrowed $200 billion, and I see from the numbers that we borrowed $175 billion to do all these projects which are spelled out, and $25 billion on top, which we probably shouldn't have. There's no way of doing that. So people take the whole $200 billion, or the total $350 billion, and they say, oh, my God, the country's run like a madman. Country's going to go bust. Countries don't go bust so easily.
So your point here is that in spite of the fact that we have this huge deficit, we should still be borrowing for things that we'll really need and that will, in the long run, improve the health of the country.
I mean, 100% absolutely. But that is quite impossible to do until people understand what you're doing. And as long as the deficit has this huge number with no explanation attached, I don't blame people the tiniest bit. The feeling that, oh, my God, I mean, my national heritage is somehow being squandered.
What do you think the consequences will be if we don't rebuild our bridges and roads and mass transit systems?
And the consequences would be that you'll break more axles in your car, blow more tires, take more time getting to Washington. And as a consequence of those personal misadventures, business doesn't run as efficiently. I mean, it takes longer, it costs more. And estimates now are estimates from very sober people that you get twice as much bang for the buck, twice as much growth in real output from a dollar put into public capital as you do from a dollar put into private capital. That's not because a road is in itself more production generating than a machine. It's just that roads are in such bad shape. Bridges are in such bad shape. The embankment of the economy is in such bad shape. That's where the payoff is. And I forgot to mention, of course, one of the most important things to borrow for, not just the kind of capital you ride on or kick with your foot. It's a kind of capital economists call human capital. It's knowledge. The scores of American students are, as you know, very alarming compared with the scores of foreign students. And there's something about our education system that's lacking. Some of it may be quite beyond anything that money will cure, but some of it is not beyond what money will cure. And we need to borrow in order to increase the stock of knowledge that people have. We need to make loans available to people who can't afford to go to college. So I'm very much in favor of public borrowing for expansion purposes. That to me is the brightest path available to lead this country back to where it should be.
If you're just joining us, my guest is economist Robert Heilbronner, and his two latest books are The Debt and the Deficit and a new edition of The Human Prospect. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Economist Robert Heilbronner is my guest. I have to get your thoughts on the fall of communism. Did you ever think that you would live to see that happen?
Never. Never. What economists do, what this economist does, who's written a number of books that are used in colleges, is look with trepidation on what I said and see what it looks like in the light of realities. And, I wrote, as everybody wrote, about the Soviet Union, using those words, USSR, as a fact of life. I mean, it was as big as Gibraltar, and it would be there for a long time. It was running, the last time I wrote most of my last editions, it was already running very badly. Then I had all sorts of projections and guesses about how it would stagger along, whether it would somehow manage to introduce more markets and the rest. But, of course, nobody imagined that it would just plain collapse.
Do you think that socialism ever got a fair shake?
It's very hard to know exactly what socialism is. I used to think I knew. I mean, we thought it meant something called planning and all the nice democratic privileges that we enjoy. Right now, I think that there is something called enlightened capitalism or public interest capitalism, and that we have it in a number of countries. I think of Austria, and I think of the Netherlands, I think of Scandinavia, and sometimes I think of the U.S., and sometimes I don't. And I do believe that capitalism comes in different packages, some very, very good and some not so good.
What's enlightened capitalism?
Well, it certainly has a high level of civil liberties, that I would say. And I think it understands that capitalism is a very complicated system with all the technology that it encourages that requires a delicate balance between what I consider to be the three big players in a modern economy. One of them is labor, one of them is business, and one of them is government. And that until you have some sort of concordat, some sort of tacit or explicit understanding about how those three parties work together, you probably aren't going to be able to use the government in a forceful way to, quote, right wrongs and do good and see that the economy goes in the right direction.
What's one example of an aspect of another country's economy or, you know, the relationship between politics and economic planning that you'd like to borrow for the United States?
Well, yes, I'll tell one in a second. Just to say a word about borrowing, something that works very well for, let's say, Sweden, may not survive the passage across the ocean at all. Ditto Japan, even more so. But I'll tell you something I like that's going on in Germany. I talked about the three players, unions and business and government. Those players have worked out something in Germany that I find very interesting. One of the great challenges that modern capitalism faces in every country is its inflationary tendency. When I was a boy, there was no inflation. I mean, when your or my grandparents took their hard-earned money and bought bonds, government bonds or railroad bonds that paid 3%, they were very happy to get the 3% and never thought that inflation would wipe it out because there wasn't any inflation. They were quite right. When they sold their bonds 20 years later, the money was usually worth more. Inflation has crept into the system for lots of reasons. The question is what to do about it. And the Germans have done the following about it. First of all, they've legitimated the role of labor. Labor unions sit on the boards of directors of big corporations, so they know there isn't some whammy going around the corner. Labor unions are assured very high unemployment benefits and don't have to get on their knees and beg for it. Labor unions are provided by the government with extensive government retraining operations when industries close down. So labor does not feel that it's up against the wall fighting for its life, and that means that labor leaders are in a position to urge and work for non-inflationary wage contracts. In this country, where every union is up against the wall all the time and where they're being zapped both by government and by business, it's each for all and devil take the hindmost, and one union competes with the other to see who can get the best short-term gains for its membership. And the consequence is, or was until the recent recession, that many union contracts were signed, particularly in the 60s and 70s, that were very inflationary. They were getting more money for their employees than their employees were earning in terms of higher productivity. So that's something that the Germans have got around by legitimizing labor. Meanwhile, labor and management won their own special agreements. Management has got the agreement from government to go and make intercompany arrangements of various sorts and to turn to government itself for financing assistance in ways that enables it to undertake a kind of high-tech, flexible organization to win shares in the world market. We have nothing like it in this country. When France, the consortium of countries that builds Airbus, let's call it France, builds the Airbus, they have the government to fall back on. Boeing doesn't have the government to fall back on. And finally, there's the government itself, which in those countries it doesn't assume for a second, no modern government would, that it knows what branch of technology is going to lead the way tomorrow. But it stands there ready to underwrite whatever looks promising. And it is regarded by both labor and management as, so to speak, the best, most disinterested party to lay down a general monetary and fiscal approach. We have nothing like that tripartite understanding.
Well, you know, you're talking about the team of government, labor, and business. It seems like in this country, political leaders are either considered to be pro-business or pro-labor, but never pro-both.
Yes, that's right. And I would love to see a public leader who managed to convey the message that I'm talking about in whatever words would have the greatest resonance with the electorate. In some way, I think Franklin Roosevelt did that. He did talk, and it wasn't just rhetoric. It was deeply meant. He did talk about putting together the forces in the economy. They weren't quite so structured as they are today. I'm an old New Dealer, I guess, unregenerate New Dealer. I'd like to see that brought back to life.
Robert Heilbrunner, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Robert Heilbrunner is the co-author of The Debt and the Deficit, published by Norton. During these tough times, every business is trying to get consumers to consume more. One of the latest sales techniques is the so-called TV infomercial, commercials that masquerade as programs. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, usually watches TV programs, but lately he's been watching infomercials, and he's found there's more and more of them.
It used to be that if you wanted to sound really cynical about television, all you had to do was say the programs were just filler between the ads, that the ads were where the power was. But now, at least on Sunday nights, many TV stations and cable networks have eliminated the middleman entirely. I've reviewed commercial programs once before, back when Bruce Weitz, Belker on Hill Street Blues, was hawking a dog training video, and Michael Landon was alive and well and pushing a video about math skills. Well, it's kind of creepy, but Landon's program continues to run long after his death. It's also creepy how pervasive these shows have become and how many forms they take. Stations show them because they get money up front to do it. Merchandisers make them because viewers watch them. And viewers watch them because, well, I guess because they're like fake TV, and they're kind of fascinating in a gruesome sort of way. There are commercial programs designed to look like cooking shows, talk shows, news magazines, even financial advice shows. In fact, I saw examples of all of these in the space of 1 hour last Sunday night, thanks to cable and a morbid curiosity. Ready for a fast tour through late-night commercial program hell? Here we go. Focus on Beauty is a talk show set up to sell Lori Davis hair products. Lori herself is the host, and her co-host is Cher.
So is Clarifier, it's a shampoo, or I'm not exactly sure. Okay. I know you always put it on me, but I'm not exactly sure what it is.
Does it? Because it foams. It's used like a shampoo, but it isn't. What it is, it's a very special hair cleanser.
I'm glad she clarified that. Next is a show called Galloping Gourmet, which has nothing to do with Graham Kerr's delightful old cooking show of the same name. This one's just a wall-to-wall ad for something called Perfection Air, which, as far as I can tell, is nothing but a high-tech bamboo steamer.
And remember, what we're going to be doing here is we're going to be rotisserieing, because the Perfection Air is actually going to blow air around the food, so we're never going to have to turn it. And these are going to be done...
Then there's the Home Shopping Network, which takes the commercial program concept to the ultimate. All commercials, all the time, 24 hours a day. At the time I popped in, its announcer was pushing an autographed Nolan Ryan jersey for a mere $398.75. At Home Shopping Network, more priority is put on enthusiasm than good grammar.
You cannot get this jersey next season, or this season. I mean, there is, Rawlings does not make the jersey. No one can even get it, because there will be no more Rawlings jerseys. So this is the last of them. So.
Here's one that looks and sounds like a news magazine, but actually is a bald-faced commercial for... Well, listen.
The dream. The reality. Let Envision bring them together for you. Join us as we meet people from all walks of life, all sharing a common problem, hair loss.
But wait, that's not all. There's also Meredith Baxter, formerly Meredith Baxter Burney, who's hosting Beauty Breakthroughs from the 90s, Part 2, to help sell cosmetics for Victoria Jackson, who, by the way, is not the one from Saturday Night Live.
I told Victoria that if she ever did another commercial program for her line, I wanted to be in it because I wanted to tell women that at last there's something out there that really is different, that can make them look a lot more beautiful without looking overly made up.
Finally, I saw two different shows about food processors pushing different brands at the same time. How's that for counter-programming? The one I liked better, in fact it's my current favorite among all these tacky shows, is co-hosted by Jack LaLanne, the original TV bodybuilder, and a young co-host with way too much enthusiasm.
You know, the experts say that we should have at least 5 or 6 or 7 vegetables a day.
Now I'm ready.
This
I'm
is
ready.
Jack's Veggie 7.
Tomato.
That's tomato, vitamin C. Then we got cucumber there.
Cucumber? Oh. Look at that. Goes right
look
through.
At it. How about that pizza?
If you're as outraged as I am about money-making ventures masquerading as programs, there's a way you can help. Just send $12.95 to... No, just kidding. But these days, no matter where you turn, it pays to keep your guard up.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Alex Chilton was just a teenager when his group The Box Tops hit it big with the songs The Letter and Cry Like a Baby. By the time he was 20, he was recording more personal and idiosyncratic material. Those records never became hits, but they inspired what became known as power pop. Now those records are being reissued. Coming up, we talk with Alex Chilton. Also, Maureen Carrigan reviews Strong Motion by novelist Jonathan Franzen. Maureen says the book's part techno-thriller, part political satire, part science fiction, and part romance. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Several U.S. military transport planes carried the first loads of food and medicine to Moscow today, much of the food left over from the Persian Gulf War. Three planes, each carrying about 40 tons of food, flew from Germany to Moscow and St. Petersburg, while nine smaller planes flew from Turkey to other cities in the former Soviet Union. Officials said that each large plane carried enough food for 100,000 meals. This airlift is part of an international effort agreed to at a conference in Washington last month. However, officials say this airlift will provide only a small part of what is needed to carry the former Soviet states toward a market economy. Serbian delegates in Croatia have overturned yesterday's decision to accept the terms of a UN peacekeeping plan. Pierre Vickery reports that delegates called for a vote on whether international peacekeeping forces should be allowed in the area.
The population of the Serbian-controlled region of Krajina in Croatia is expected to go to the polls on February the 22nd to decide whether to allow United Nations peacekeeping troops into their territory. The president of the self-declared republic, Milan Babic, has resisted intense pressure from the Serbian authorities in Belgrade to accept the United Nations peace plan, which would place three areas of Croatia under UN protection. Dr. Babic argues that the plan in its present form is unacceptable, and the referendum will ask voters to support his demands for additional guarantees that the Serbian population in the territory will be protected. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
Flash flood warnings have been issued for a large portion of Los Angeles as torrential rain hit the area this afternoon. 46 people have been rescued by helicopter after the street where they were driving suddenly became a river. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
The worst flooding occurred in the San Fernando Valley. Motorists described driving down a street with perhaps a foot of water on it when all of a sudden their cars were filled with rising water. Many scrambled to the roofs of their cars and were rescued. Others apparently swam to higher ground or found trees to climb before they could be rescued. Helicopters, inflatable rafts, even canoes were used in the rescue effort. Three of the 46 people who were rescued were sent to hospitals. All are said to be in satisfactory condition. The flooded area is adjacent to the Los Angeles River Flood Control Area and is the known low point. This storm moved into Southern California last evening. In addition to flooding, the storm has brought mudslides and landslides. One residential area in Malibu is now being evacuated. This is Wendy Kaufman reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 20 points. This is NPR News. In Iowa, voters gather at caucuses this evening, but without the competition of presidential elections of the past. President Bush is unopposed in the state among Republicans, and uncommitted Democrats appear to be the biggest threat to Iowa Senator Tom Harkin. Next week, voters in New Hampshire vote in that state's primary, and Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton today vowed to, in his words, fight like hell during the final 8 days in the wake of questions about his personal life. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
Speaking in Nashua, New Hampshire today, a defiant Clinton said the past few weeks have descended into a bizarre series of diversions, and he resolved to return the focus of the campaign to issues rather than his personal life. While dismissing recent charges of infidelity as trash, Clinton said questions about his draft status during the Vietnam War are a legitimate issue. The governor has been accused of joining an ROTC program to get a deferment for 2 months in 1968 when he was likely to be drafted. But Clinton insisted that despite his opposition to the war, he gave up the protection of the deferment when he realized he had not done the right thing by taking it.
I made myself available for the draft. I had no idea what my lottery number was going to be or whether it would be called. That is the fact.
Clinton accused unnamed Republicans of being actively involved in spreading stories about his personal life. I'm Andy Bowers in Manchester, New Hampshire.
And in Romania, early returns indicate strong support for the anti-communist coalition in local elections. Yesterday's voting was viewed as a test of the opposition Democratic Convention's chances against the ruling National Salvation Front for presidential elections this spring. However, most local elections are expected to go to a second vote in 2 weeks' time. These were the first free elections in more than 50 years in the country. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. To a lot of people who came of age in the 60s, Alex Chilton is best known as the singer with the box tops, the growly voice on The Letter and Cry Like a Baby. After his AM radio hits, Chilton left the box tops and formed his own band, Big Star. This band was a commercial flop, but their records from the 70s influenced a lot of younger musicians and made Chilton a cult figure. The Big Star albums led Village Voice rock critic Robert Christgau to call Chilton the inventor of self-conscious power pop and to describe his music as prophetically idiosyncratic and breathtakingly original. Ryko Disc has just brought out 3 CDs of reissued and previously unreleased Big Star sessions. I spoke with Chilton last May when Rhino Records brought out the anthology 19 Years, a collection of Alex Chilton. We started where Chilton's recording career began, with a number one hit.
Give me a ticket for an aeroplane. Ain't got time to take a fast train. Lonely days are gone, I'm a-going home. My baby just wrote me a letter. I don't care how much money I gotta spend. Got to get back to my baby again. Lonely days are gone, I'm a-going home. My baby just wrote me a letter.
Alex Chilton, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks.
I want to talk with you first about the early part of your recording career. You started recording with the Box Tops when you were 16. Can you tell me how you got a chance like that at such a young age?
Well, Memphis was a hotbed of recording activity, Memphis, where I grew up. And, you know, I was asked to join a kind of successful local band who made records at sort of a successful independent producer's studio. And after I'd been with them about a month, we went in the studio and recorded our first hit song. And so it was just something that was easy to fall into. It was sort of like growing up in Hollywood next door to MGM's studio lot or something, you know?
Right. Now, on those early sessions with the Box Tops, you have this real, you know, kind of rough, growly kind of voice. And your voice is completely different on your subsequent work. Did you sing that way at the time, or were you asked to sing that way?
Well, the producer of the band was a strong influence on how we sounded, and he would sort of demonstrate to me how he wanted things sung, and I would pretty much just imitate his singing. His name was Dan Penn, still is Dan Penn.
So did you feel like it wasn't really you on the records in that respect?
In a way, I do. I listen to it and I go, wow, Dan's really in voice today. It sounds more like Dan than it does myself to me.
What was it like handling fame at the age of 16? Were you prepared for it?
Oh, I mean, I don't know that anybody's prepared to handle fame. But then again, I think it would have made a lot more difference if I'd been a true believer in my own fame, too. But as it was, you know, we were kind of doing the bidding of producers and recording songs that were not our own, and it was sort of a job to me. I wasn't such a great fan of our group that I was really caught up in thinking that I was a tremendous great artist or anything at the time.
When did you leave the Box Tops and start your own group?
In 1970, I left the Box Tops, and I guess the next year I started the group called Big Star.
Now, let me ask you about one of the first records that you made on your own after the Box Tops, and this is a song you wrote called Free Again. that kicks off the compilation of the Alex Chilton CD that Rhino recently brought out. Do you want to say anything about what was going through your mind when you wrote the song?
Sure. You know, I guess that it's some kind of tune of some kind of liberation as far as the lyrics. But I was a big fan of the Flying Burrito Brothers at the time, and, you know, country rock was sort of something I was getting interested in. So it sounds very country rocky and, you know, with the pedal steel guitar and all.
Let's hear it. When you formed the band Big Star, was there an intended irony behind the name?
I guess so. We'd been together for some time without a name, and somehow there was a store across the street called the Big Star, and while wondering what we should call ourselves, we looked across the street, and somehow it seemed perfect. So I guess, yeah, there was an irony in calling our first album number one record by a group called Big Star. I guess we thought it was funny at the time.
Yeah, well, I guess it kind of stayed funny in the sense that never...
That we never sold any records, yeah.
Was that a great disappointment to you?
I don't know. I wasn't really counting on selling a whole lot of records or anything, you know. I mean, I thought that someday if we ever sold any records, I might make some money out of it. That myth has been exploded for me also. But, you know, I didn't have any great emotional investment in the success or failure of the record in commercial terms.
Yeah, choose one of the songs from the early sessions that really still works for you, you know what I mean, that really sums up for you the kind of sound you wanted to get.
Well, my favorite song from the first Big Star record is called In the Street, you know, and I think that that's sort of the best song that I wrote in that period, and somehow it just turned out great, you know, on tape. These things happen sometimes for no good reason.
Let's hear it. Your records ended up being very influential to a lot of bands who were coming up at the time. The Replacements even have a song called Alex Chilton. When did you get a sense of the impact that your music was having on other musicians, even if it wasn't having a big impact commercially?
I guess in the late 70s, I spent some time in New York, and it seemed like everybody I ran into there, you know, claimed to be a fan of the Big Star albums and that sort of stuff. And so, you know, I guess it was around then that I began to see that even though we hadn't sold any records or made any money out of the albums, that they were still some kind of success in a way, you know.
What would they tell you? What kind of specific stories did people tell you about the impact your music had on them?
Mostly what it is young guys coming up who are like learning to play guitar, you know. They seem to reach a certain stage where this record shows them something, you know. it's that I think that that's what people go for about it. That's what they all seem to gravitate toward, is this jangly guitar sound that's happening there.
My guest is Alex Chilton. He started his career as the lead singer of the Box Tops. His more obscure subsequent recordings are collected on the CD 19 Years, a collection of Alex Chilton. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Alex Chilton is my guest. A lot of people call your music one of the first albums of power pop. What does that expression mean to you?
I don't know, really. I mean, to me, we were more like, our band was more like the mid-60s British invasion music. You know, it was like three-minute pop songs that were kind of unpretentious and very basically about love and just being a teenager and having a good time, you know. For me, music, once it entered the psychedelic era there in the 60s, I became less interested in it. I like simple pop songs with no real message, you know, just about feeling good and being happy.
Are you ever on the oldies circuit playing?
Absolutely, yeah.
You are?
Yeah, I played a gig with the Beach Boys a couple of weeks ago. That was thrilling. I got to even sing Surfin' USA on stage with them. It was the greatest thrill of my career.
So what's it like for you on the oldie circuit? Tell me what you like and dislike about it.
Well, I enjoy meeting all these bands that I've heard of for so long, you know, like... I've played some gigs lately with Question Mark from Question Mark and the Mysterians, and he's a lot of fun. It's interesting to be, you know, hanging around hotel lobbies with Question Mark and that sort of stuff. So, you know, in the summer times, it seems like people offer me some gigs, you know, with 60s bands and things like that, and it's fun to do now and then.
So what do you play?
Well, it's pretty strictly Box Tops material that's called for, and usually it's a five-song set, you know? So it's kind of easy money. You just get up and play five or six tunes at a county fair in Iowa or North Dakota or something, and it's kicky, you know? What can I say?
In the late 70s, you started... becoming really part of the punk scene, and you produced records by the Cramps, you produced their first records. What attracted you to that? You'd already been around a while, and a lot of people in it were just coming up.
I don't know, everybody since the 60s, it seems like everybody who was still interested in playing rock and roll kept looking for, well, where is the new scene going to be, you know? We've got to have a scene going here so that we can all get involved in it and do good things. And I think that in New York in the mid-70s was the nearest thing to a scene, like the London scene or the Los Angeles scene in the 60s, you know. So I sort of gravitated to it because there was an anarchistic sort of edge to it, and it wasn't some corporate showcase of Stepford Wives bands, you know, playing up there. It was real rebellious, good rock and roll that was coming from street level rather than corporate boardroom level.
Do you still think of your rock and roll as being rebellious?
I don't know. I do in a way that it doesn't conform to industry standards, you know. I mean, I may not be... I mean, well, I am a very rebellious person against the society that we live in. I'm not so sure that that comes out in a big way in the music that I'm doing at the moment, but one goes through different phases, you know? I mean, just sometimes the most outrageous thing you could do would be to do the most normal thing that anybody could do, which is sort of a plan that I have right now. If I may, the next music that I'm making, I'm thinking of making it the most sort of, I don't know how to describe it, but some very, very normal, uncontroversial pop tunes, you know, that that have nothing much kinky about them except a strong beat and a positive outlook, you know.
You've been so influential on so many people in rock, and yet, you know, you're kind of functioning independently. You don't have a record contract. Mm-hmm. There isn't a big company after you to record something now. What explanation do you have for... I'm always interested when someone of your talents is kind of not more sought after.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It seems to me that the world is full of great musicians who don't have any record companies interested in them. It seems to me that the record companies are interested in bands of teenage guys, you know, with long hair and playing heavy metal music, or whatever the next trend will be, you know. And I'm not really so concerned about it. I mean, I've sort of got my scene going and have carved out a little niche, however little it is, in the music business, you know. And I managed to play as many gigs as I want every year and make money doing that, and make a little money here and there making records, and it's okay with me.
What is that scene?
What is the niche that I've carved out, you know?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I can play in these college towns and get my records played on college radio and that sort of stuff.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Alex Chilton, Rykodisc has just brought out 3 CDs of re-released and previously unreleased Big Star sessions. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. NPR's John Burnett reports on workplace problems in some of the U.S.-owned plants operating in Mexico, a charge of birth defects children born to mothers working in those plants, a discussion of President Bush's directive to Congress, notification of action underway to get rid of Iraq's Saddam Hussein. Also, Deidre Berger travels quickly to the Soviet Union from Germany, going along with food relief shipments. A major airlift is underway. Andy Bowers reports from New Hampshire on efforts there to start a write-in campaign for New York's Governor Mario Cuomo. Also, Verda Mae Grosvenor has a remembrance of the writer Alex Haley, who has died at age 70.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Jonathan Franzen's first novel, The 27th City, was hard to categorize, an epic book that was part spy novel, part novel of manners, part weird science fiction. Now he's come out with his second novel, Strong Motion, and critic Maureen Corrigan says he's at it again.
We all know that the Cliff Note people can compress any novel, no matter how unwieldy, into digestible yellow and black pellets. Still, I think Jonathan Franzen's Strong Motion would cause brows to furrow at the Cliff Note compacting room. It's not that Franzen's novel is difficult. On the contrary, this techno-thriller about a series of bizarre earthquakes around Boston starts out like a high art version of a Clive Cussler adventure story. But as Franzen demonstrated in The 27th City, when it comes to narrative genres, he's a polygamist. Strong Motion slides from its opening action-adventure mode into science fiction, political satire, and surrealist farce. In this 500-page novel, Franzen also crams in something like 50 subplots. Where most young novelists are starving themselves into slim, fast minimalists, Franzen, to his credit, has never stopped believing in the motto of his overstuffed Victorian literary ancestors, "Big is beautiful." Strong Motion's primary plot focuses on Lewis Holland, a 23-year-old Holden Caulfield type. I bonded with Lewis in the first chapter when he meets his sister Eileen's blowhard boyfriend, Peter. "So, Lewis," Peter said, "tell us a little about yourself." "I work for a radio station," Lewis said in a very level voice. "It's called WSNE?" "Sure," Peter said. "I'm familiar with it. Not that I ever listen, but I've dealt with them a couple of times. One thing I'd suggest is to try to get paid at the end of every week." "Peter sells ad space for Boston Magazine," Eileen said. "Among other things," Peter said. "He knows so much stuff, Lewis," said Eileen. "He knows tons more than I do." "Do you know how to listen?" Lewis said suddenly. Peter's eyes narrowed. "What do you mean?" "Do you know how to listen when you've asked somebody a question about themselves?" That's the kind of drop-dead remark that only people in novels think fast enough to make. Lewis falls in love with Renee Sycheck, a Harvard seismologist and conflicted feminist. Renee figures out that the Boston earthquakes are caused by massive toxic waste dumping. In her spare time, Renee is also being harassed by a right-to-life group. This convergence of the environmentalist and right-to-life plots leads Franzen to make a queasy connection between the way male technology pumps toxins into pure, passive Mother Nature and the way men, well, you get it. Somehow, Franzen emerges on the side of reproductive rights, but I wish he'd taken a less metaphorical route. In fact, despite its loopy lushness, I wish Strong Motion were a more straightforward novel altogether. The earthquake plot is so intriguing that the subplots and genre shifts begin to be a drag. And though Strong Motion starts out with strong emotion about its characters and political themes, Franzen seems to get bored or embarrassed halfway through, and an alienating, satirical attitude takes over. On the fiction Richter scale, I'd give Strong Motion a solid 7. I liked its engagement with hot contemporary issues, and I also liked its riskiness. But what can I tell you? Strong Motion didn't make me feel the earth move.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Strong Motion by Jonathan Franzen, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next edition of Fresh Air, we examine a hidden drug problem, drugs that are cheap, accessible, legal, and very dangerous. We'll talk about inhalant abuse, getting high on substances like glue, gasoline, and many aerosol products. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.